Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, veteran prosecutor from Savannah, Chatham County, Georgia. Listeners have met Detective Allie Nichols before. Her hard work and dedication on the investigation of the murders of Kiana Marshall, Corey Marshall, and Alexis Kitchens put killers James Hampton and Dwayne Abney away for life without parole. The first case I had with her was equally epic, though. Bonnie and Clyde killers Laquan Brown and Rashard Mosley wreaked havoc in the Savannah area in 2014. As it became apparent they were targeting older men, it took Allie's tenacity and good judgment to ensure they were found and stopped before they killed again. But it also took a team of the area's best detectives to nail this case down. Join us on the hunt for Bonnie and Clyde.
Hi there!
Hi!
It's so good to see you!
So good to see you.
Oh God, Allie, it's always wonderful to see you. And I'm just thrilled that you are able to do this with me, because this was we're getting to talk about our first big case together.
Yes, this was our baby.
This was our baby. And when I think about it, so you are Detective Allie Nichols. You're always going to be Detective Allie Nichols in my mind, or Detective Allie Reese. You were Allie Reese back then.
I was. Yes, I was.
Wow. God, that's crazy. So you obviously were with Savannah Chatham Metropolitan Police Department back in 2014. How long had you been a police officer at that point?
I started the academy January of 2011. So if you count the academy, I guess you could say a few years, but officially under 3 years.
Okay. And you had, and I'm trying to remember exactly your trajectory to get into homicide, because that's pretty quick. So tell me how that went.
I started out on patrol, and I've always kind of been proactive or had that mentality, even being a new officer. But you know, with that comes making a lot of mistakes and stuff like that. I was your typical, like, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed rookie, you know, just wanting to arrest people and do a good job. And I was playing flag football with some guys at the department. Like one Saturday, we had like a flag football thing where we'd go out and play it like every Saturday. And I ended up tearing my ACL.
Oh my.
Yeah, that was my second time tearing an ACL playing flag football. So I should have known better. But anyways, so I had surgery. I went on light duty, and while I was in light duty, I just kind of, I worked in the precinct, and I really didn't have like officially anything to do. Like I could kind of do whatever I wanted to do. And so I'd like look at some of the detectives' cases and kind of just do my own homework and research on them. And I think I did pretty good and helped them out a little bit. And then there was a particular case where this guy had stolen a car with a baby in it while a woman was checking her mail at an apartment complex. Wow. And based on the description and the location, like I, again, did some digging, and I went to Sergeant Tobar at the time, who was the, he was the sergeant over the detectives in precinct 4 where I was at. And I was like, hey, I think this is your guy right here. And I showed him, and then they locate patrol or detective, somebody located them and questioned him, and it come to find out it was him. And he was really impressed by that. So at some point after that, Sergeant Tobar went up to homicide and became sergeant over homicide. And when I was off light duty, he, you know, always remembered me and, like, I guess thought highly of me. So I got a call one day, and I think it was him, and he was asking me if I wanted to come up there. And I just remember, you know, like thinking that was the coolest opportunity, but I was just so deathly scared, like, of everything, you know, because I had no experience as a detective, never done a search warrant, never done an interview. So
yeah, they're throwing you to the wolves at that point.
Yeah, I was extremely intimidated, but I couldn't say no. So I said yes. And I remember, you know, just getting up there and just trying to, like, keep my head down and be real humble, because I, you know, I didn't know the first thing. I just had my work ethic.
Yeah. Yeah. And that has shown across the board. We are going to get into what an incredible work ethic you have. But I wanted to give a shout out to Sergeant, oh my God, he's now Captain Tober, I think. And he's just fabulous.
He's awesome.
Really good guy.
Like the best attitude. He's always had like just such a great attitude.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, really good guy. And he's still there, thank God. So there's still some stability in the Seattle department. But he is a great guy. And I think is worth, mentioning what, because when we get together and talk, you just start thinking about all of the people that we aren't talking about. Right.
Right.
And, it's such a team effort across the board. We've just been so, so fortunate to work with really good people. And there was one thing that came up that I want to talk about later, that struck me after the fact, that's like, oh my God, this person needs to be talked about too, or talked to or brought on or something at some point. Sergeant Tober is, or Captain Tober, yikes. I feel really old. He's such a good guy. I'm glad you brought that up because, I think he has been a great mentor to a lot of really, really good detectives and officers over the years. So that's fantastic. Yeah. And there is my stupid house phone. I'm hoping to have and I will edit this out. I probably will.
Yeah.
I love it. Not being the technical genius, but so you got into homicide with no detective experience.
Yeah.
Who did you hang out with?
Ross. Detective Chris Ross. He was a friend of mine. He was in precinct 4, which was the Southside precinct. So we were, I don't think we worked on the street together, but when I got there, he was a detective in the Southside precinct and I was an officer. We just kind of clicked and became friends. And so when I got asked to go up there, I think I talked to Ross before I made my decision, but I just remember like talking to him and just telling him how afraid I was, I just didn't want to mess anything up. But when I got there, I clung to his side. Like I rode with him my first day. He showed me the ropes. He's always been a great friend. And then he's just an awesome interviewer. So I remember I learned so much just sitting on interviews with him.
He is a great, great guy. And of course I've had him on, I want to have him back on. I was tempted to do it with this. Because I know he, again, this case is such a team effort case, and so I want to talk about him too. So you were hanging out with Ross, and I think he mentioned that you tagged along on Lauren Brown's case.
Yeah, I got called out for that one. He was lead on it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was such a good guy. So was this, where in the scheme of things did this case fit as far as going solo for you?
This was my second, it could have been my third homicide, but it was one of my first. I know it wasn't my first one, but it was, this was 2014, correct?
Yeah.
So I started in homicide in January 2014, and I didn't get my first case for a few months. So this probably was my second case.
Yeah, this would have been July 30th.
Yes, and my birthday is July 29th, and I remember being really upset when I got the call. it was supposed to be Detective Eric Smith's case, but he was out of town or something. So I took his spot in the on-call roster, and I thought I was going to have a weekend to celebrate my birthday, and that got taken away. With a phone call. So
wow.
When I was in the bigger picture, I was really thankful to have gotten this case because it was such a unique case with like a lot of like twists and turns, and it was very interesting. So when it was all said and done, I was really thankful that I did get to work this as the lead detective.
Right. And we are going to talk about what a fabulous job you did with this, but this really is, because this case has what I keep referring to as sprawl. I mean, this case had a lot of crimes involved. And so it had a lot to it. So you get this case and it happened, the shooting itself happened like
right after midnight. Is that right? Or was it the next night? So like 11 something at night.
I just remember it was nighttime. I don't recall the time per se. Right.
I know it was, I know all those forensics pictures are dark.
Yeah. So, I remember being dark. Yep. Right. I remember being like, where's my crime scene? Cause there was like nothing there. I had a one shell casing and a little bit of blood on the street. And that was
right.
That was it.
Right. So what, so tell me how this works, or tell our listeners how this works. You get called out. What happens?
I get called out. I get like a very brief rundown of what I've got, which, you know, in the early stages is practically nothing. You know, you got a victim who has been transported from the scene to the hospital. And I don't remember if I was told he was already dead or if he was probably going to die when I got that call. But either way, the fact that I was being called out, we knew that he was likely to pass if he hadn't already passed. But yeah, I got a call. I got, you know, just a few details, the location, you know, I got a victim. So I put my clothes on and I headed out the door and I drove straight to the location. And when I got there, I remember, you know, being walked through my very limited crime scene. And what I did have was the victim, Ivory Carter's cell phone that he dropped prior to him being transported to the hospital, which turns out that was going to be a really key piece of evidence in this case. So of course, the first thing I wanted to do was to get into that phone to see if he had made any calls, you know, just prior to the shooting, or if anybody had called him, or what that looked like in his phone leading up to the shooting.
Well, right. So you've got like, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was a young boy, James Hazard. Did you talk to him, or was he talked to by somebody else?
I spoke to him. He was transported to headquarters. He was like, I want to say he was, you know,
he was 12, a teenager,
13, 14 years old. Yeah. Right in there, a young teenager, but he was very mature, very well spoken, and had a great memory of what he witnessed that night. So that night, his dad was taking him driving and he was just kind of driving around practicing. I think he was 14 and he was like preparing to, you know, take a driving test or something. And he and his dad pull into their driveway. You know, this kid is driving and all of a sudden they hear some pops and they look in the direction of the pops and they see what James Hazard Jr. describes as a like dark colored crossover, which at the time I didn't know what a crossover was. He had to explain it to me. It's like a small SUV, but at the time I was like, what's a crossover? Because I think they were new.
Right.
And he said he saw several people standing around the vehicle. And then he saw all but one of those people get into the car. And then the car took off and he saw the victim running down the road in their direction, yelling for help. And that's basically what he saw.
Right. And that, you know, if I remember right, he saw like Ivory Carter just collapsed in front of him.
Yes. Collapsed in their driveway, in fact. I don't know if Ivory saw them and was, you know, thinking, hey, there's people here, let me get to them or what, but he ended up actually in their driveway.
This is so sad. And traumatic, I know, for James Hazard, because, you know, obviously I met him later, significantly after the fact, but, you know, I think that stuck with him for a very long time.
Yeah. Especially as a kid, you know, that will stay with you forever.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And you're so right. I mean, so totally articulate and mature and just, you know, very together, you know. I mean, for a kid that age particularly is really impressive.
Yeah.
So you have that information, and obviously there's no car there because how else would Ivory Carter have gotten there? Mm-hmm. So you've got something to look for.
Yes.
But you got into the phone. Was that like the first big break we got with this, was getting into the phone?
Yes.
Okay. So what'd you find in the phone?
I found a phone number in his call log that like he had been calling and that had been calling him, like leading right up into the time of the shooting. I want to say like within a minute or two, even, because we had ShotSpotter at the time, and I believe we were able, I think we knew the exact time of the shots, if I'm not mistaken. And so
I don't know if I even presented the ShotSpotter evidence in this case, because we had near an eyewitness. So I don't think I did.
No, you know, I could be wrong about that. We could have gotten ShotSpotter later on, but
it's fine. I just don't remember.
We did have like a really, like we had it narrowed down to like pretty much when the shots happened. And so I could tell when I looked through the phone and I could see these calls, I'm like, I remember thinking, oh wow, like this is literally right before the shooting. So these phone numbers are going to be, this particular phone number that he keeps calling, him is going to be important.
Right. And that was an 864 something, something number.
Yeah. I have out of town number. Yeah.
So what do you do with a phone number? I mean, a lot of times, oh, gee, that's nice. What, you have a phone number. What did you do to try to run this down?
So I quickly got a search warrant for that phone number for the records. And when I got those records back, we were able to see that whoever had that phone was in the location of the homicide at the time of the homicide.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So the location was super helpful. Did you do something else? Because I seem to remember there was some interagency stuff that went on using that number. What happened with that? Like, did you run it through one of your systems to find out if it had come up anywhere else? Or
yes. So I ran that phone number in one of our databases and discovered that there had been a report made just days prior with that phone number. And there was a report made in, I think it was Garden City, of a victim who said that he had a friend named Quan who called him on that number and asked for a ride. And so he agreed, and he left his apartment to, you know, pick her up and give her a ride wherever she wanted to go. And when he got to the location that she asked him to meet him at, she wasn't there, and he called the number repeatedly and she wasn't answering. And so he came back to his apartment only to find that it had been burglarized, and he was missing, like, I think some TVs and other items. I can't remember what they were. And so obviously he called the police and made a police report, and he gives the police her phone number. So I was able to pull that report pretty early on in this investigation and thought, you know, that's interesting. And I want to know who Quan is.
Right. Who is Quan? Let's find out who Quan is.
Yeah.
But was there any lead on who she was? What were you able to do with that? I mean, it just seemed like that's still kind of a nice piece of information, but kind of thing.
Well, thankfully, Lindsay Talley, who's now she might be a captain.
I think she is a captain.
Yeah.
In Garden City. And again, awesome shout out. She's terrific.
Yep. She's always done great work. Thankfully, she investigated that burglary and was able to identify Quan as being Laquan Brown. But she was never able to gather enough probable cause, I guess, or wasn't able to establish probable cause to make an arrest in a burglary, but she was able to identify Quan as Laquan Brown, which is all I needed. That was very helpful to me.
Right.
So I got that information from her.
So did you try to find Laquan Brown?
I did.
How'd that go?
Not well. Early on, she was hard to find, obviously, because, you know, we would later learn that she was committing a string of crimes and obviously did not want to be contacted by law enforcement. So she, you know, obviously she didn't come forward, or she didn't have a stable address. You know, I could just knock on the door and locate her.
Yeah, I'm laughing, but it's almost like nervous laughter, because what was actually going on is so creepy. It's hard to even fathom it. But yeah, so how is it that we got to break this open a little bit?
So, I'm trying to think, because I remember the Hampton Inn, which was right around the corner, like a half mile or less from where this murder occurred. I remember once I learned that Laquan and her boyfriend Richard and her cousin Keith had stayed there that night, I remember getting video, and that video was really huge. But
I think that was after the fact, though. I think that was after we knew about all these other crimes.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember how we got.
I don't know. I mean, because Becca Gregory. So in this time frame, I think Prince Owen's case is like July 26th, something like that. And then we have this murder.
Yes.
And then I'm sure there's other stuff, but that we don't know about still. But Becca Gregory catches an armed robbery.
Yes.
And you know, again, awesome detective. Was working in robbery at that time in at SCMPD, and she gets an armed robbery in that neighborhood where they ended up being located.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember anything about that armed robbery. I remember it in like excruciating detail, and Isabel, obviously, she handled those witnesses at trial. Do you remember anything about it?
Yeah, I remember it. Probably not. I'm not sure I remember as well as you do, but I do.
Oh, go ahead.
I do remember it. Yeah. So basically, in that armed robbery, Laquan had called her friend Frederick, and all these men are.
No, that's the next one. This is George Jackson. Right. So okay. Frederick Knight, and did you catch that one? Because no. Becca had George Jackson, which was August 3rd. And then Frederick Knight, was that hers too? Or did Alan get that? I can't remember.
I think Alan took that because of what was going on, because it was related to the homicide. I think he took that from the robbery unit and said, I'm keeping this one. Okay, George Jackson, yes. Yeah, so yes, it was in this area.
Right, so it's also Laquan called an older guy.
Yeah, it's all the same MO.
Right.
So Laquan called George Jackson one night, and this was in the area where she was hiding out at her cousin's house, Marty Singleton. Mm-hmm. And so he pulls up to her, I think also, was it to give her a ride somewhere? I think.
You know, he never would tell. I don't know if you're
right. He wasn't cooperative.
He was not. And Becca was so frustrated with him. I think she wanted to slap him. She was so angry, which I empathize, which is why we needed Isabel, because somebody needs to be called. I mean, I don't know that anybody really thinks of Isabel as calm necessarily, but compared to me in this circumstance, and certainly compared to Becca, because I really think Becca was very angry with him. So my recollection is like George, there's all these calls between George Jackson's number and Marty Singleton's number, because by this time Laquan's switching up the phone.
Yeah.
And so there are a bunch of calls back and forth, and he reports that he goes to like a street over or two streets over from where Marty was living, she was on Cornwall Street.
Yes.
But George Jackson pulls up to wherever that is, and it might have been Gwinnett, I can't remember. But that area. And she's on the passenger side, and she opens the door, and she's got the gun this time. And a guy gets in the back seat, and Mr. Jackson says that he fights with her over the gun, and the guy gets hold of the gun. So he's losing the fight over the gun. So he jumps out and runs.
Well, at one point, we suspect it was Richard in the car, but of course he would never cooperate. Yeah. But right. Richard says, give me the gun. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He tells Laquan, give me the gun.
Right. Right. Because she's not doing it right.
Maybe she was passing the gun to Richard when George tried to intercept it, I think.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, and you're right. I remember sitting there, and I remember like making what I thought was a reasonable inference, and I still think it is, at trial, that she was like, hey, let me use the gun this time. You know, like it was her her chance, because they, and we got a lot more to talk about as far as like things we found out about this from your investigation, which is incredibly, incredibly helpful and detailed. But so there's, you know, there's this fight over the gun and he runs. And my recollection, when we met with him prior to trial, he told us, me and Isabel, that the guy had fired at him. But when it came down to it at trial, he didn't repeat that. So, you know, but he didn't, he wouldn't admit that he'd been calling her. So, you know, it's just like, he was so frustrating as a witness.
Yeah.
But he went and like banged on someone's door and they called 911 and, you know, they had tried to drive his car off, but I guess it like died or something. I can't remember. They definitely got his keys though, because he couldn't drive the car and his keys were taken.
Yeah.
Because I know that is evidence we got later. So
I remember we got Marty Singleton's phone records, or no, we got George Jackson's phone records. And when I say we, I mean Becca did, through a search warrant. I remember the day that she stood at my desk. She was still in robbery, and I said, "Give me Marty's phone number." And I did Control F because I wanted to see if it'd pop up in the records anywhere. And we at this point, like me and her, didn't know.
Right.
And she gives me Marty Singleton's phone number, and I click enter, and up highlighted is George Jackson's phone number. And that was like the aha moment for both of us. Like, yep, they know each other. Like, because he tried to play it off like this was some random,
yeah,
first some random female and, you know, couple that did this to him, and he had no idea. And so the moment that we saw Marty's phone number pop up in his records, we knew, all right, this is, you know, he knows her. He's, you know, and he wasn't coming off of it, but we knew what it was at that moment.
Right. And I think that's part of the reason she was so angry. And part of it too was, you know, his relationship, because he is the ex-husband of Edna Jackson. And Edna had been our mayor. I mean, there's all kind of, you know, whatever with this. And, you know, he sounded very upright. Like when you would talk to him, he's like, oh, we need to do things about crime and it's bad and it's all of these things. But then he would, pardon me?
Wasn't he a preacher or a minister or something too?
I think part-time. Yeah, I think so. And yeah. So he came across as being like this really upright guy. And I think, you know, a lot of these guys felt like they were helping Laquan, like she was like a down and out person. And so I think there was an element of that, but we all know from Frederick Knight, and we're going to get to Frederick Knight, that it wasn't quite as pure and clean and sweet as, you know, they wanted to portray it necessarily. So anyway, but Frederick Knight was like straight up about it. So yeah. That happens on the third. You're working it at this point. Cause, and I don't know, I can't remember exactly the sequence of events, but you on the fourth is when Frederick Knight's case happens. So what do you remember about Frederick?
So, yeah. So this was after the homicide. And so again, Laquan calls Frederick, asks for a ride or something like that. Frederick,
no, he was there hooking up. I
mean, yeah. Well, yeah,
I think he was like fudging about that. I think he was pretty straight up about that.
Right. And Laquan asks him to meet her. It was almost in front of the house where she was staying at. It was on Cornwall, and so he pulls up in his truck. Laquan opens the passenger door as if she's gonna get in. And then Rashard walks up to the driver's side and puts a gun in his face. And this is broad daylight.
And yeah, it was like 2 p.m.
Yeah. And I think he told him to get out the truck, or he was pretty much carjacking him. He wanted the truck, I believe.
Right. That's certainly the way they were acting. Now, I don't know. I don't know that Frederick ever testified about exactly what was said, but he was clear that he had the impression they were taking his truck.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it ever got to the point where actually Rashard made any statements. I don't remember, but you're right. Frederick definitely was under the impression that they were robbing him and, you know, they were going to take his truck. So Rashard puts the gun in Frederick's face. And then he says that he had his foot on the brake. it wasn't in park or anything like that. So he said he takes his foot off the brake, puts it on the gas, and just guns it. And as he's gunning it, he hears gunshots. And Richard, I mean, shot up his truck, but there was a shot that came really close to hitting him. That is probably that first shot. And it hit, like, didn't it hit the bottom of the window?
Yeah.
Still, like, of the driver's window.
Yeah.
And did it lodge into, like, the back headrest or something?
There were a couple of shots. So there was one that was, like, right into the window there. And, like, there was one in there. There were a couple in the back. And there's one I know went through the back windshield. Mm-hmm. I cannot remember if that lodged in the headrest or not. But there were like a couple in the bed of his truck. I mean, it was terrifying.
Yeah. He said in the trial that shot that hit the bottom of the window. He testified like he could have very easily died. Like, I mean, he thought he was going to die that day. That's the shot that scared him.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And he was, you know, he did exactly the thing you should do, which is like he gets out of there and goes straight to the precinct.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And he tells them, this is where this happened. And it was, if I remember right, I always think it's Greg Ernst. I feel like Greg Ernst goes over that because Greg Ernst is everywhere. So like he goes over to this crime scene. It's like raining or whatever, but they found like all the shell casings mm-hmm. in front of the house.
Yeah.
And I cannot remember exactly how it was that it like y'all in homicide ended up taking it. Because typically I think there might've been a fight over because it was a shooting, but it might've been a robbery, but I think there was one of those, is it straight violent crimes or not? Cause y'all at that point were doing all of the eggs too, all the aggravated assaults, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So if it was just a shooting, then y'all would have gotten that. But if it were a robbery, it would go to robbery.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
But we suspected, you know, as soon as we heard about that case, we suspected it was Laquan. And right. I think we had Richard identified at that time. So Laquan and Richard. And so it being likely related to the homicide, Alan Sammons, who is one of the greatest detectives I've ever had the privilege of working with, took that case. And I was glad he did.
You know, I love Alan. So, you know, I feel like this was so, and I think that's part of what I love about working with you too, is like, you are so great at like getting a whole team of people, like, let's get everybody, you know, let's get all of the minds together. And I love that too. So it's like, great. You know, I'm like all of that kind of input and feedback and, you know, all of that stuff. So that's been really great, you know, in working with you. Cause, you know, I know that you like to bring in all of the people. And so I was really thrilled that Alan got it too. So Alan gets that case and he talked to Frederick Knight. I know he talked to Frederick Knight multiple times, but there was a lot of confusion. I don't know if you remember, I shouldn't say, but like a lot of craziness with the photo lineups.
Right before you said it, I was thinking, I remember all the craziness with the photo lineups.
Right. So tell me what you remember.
So Alan, you know, obviously we put Laquan in a photo lineup and, you know, we're hoping that he picks her because we highly suspected it was her. And Alan presents the photo lineup to Frederick and he can't identify her. And we're confused because Frederick's pretty straight up about, like you said, about what happened and doesn't deny, you know, knowing Laquan before the shooting. And so I think Alan asked him, like, you know, do you usually wear contacts or glasses? And he's like, oh yeah, I have glasses that I wear, pretty much can't see anything without them. So he's like, well, let's go get glasses and do this again. Right. So I they might have been in his truck or something. So we get his glasses, and I think it was after he got his glasses, he did identify Laquan, but then so he puts Richard in a photo lineup, and I think he he's pretty sure it's this guy, but he's not 100%. He never fully positively identified Rashard. I think he said he kind of resembled this guy, but he wasn't able to 100% identify him.
Right. And I think there was a later photo lineup too. Like after Laquan Rashard got arrested, there was another photo lineup that had a more recent picture. And I think he did ID from the most recent picture because the hair was different or something, but it was a lot more work than you normally see with a photo.
Yeah. And we were a little worried about it because we were like,
that was challenged.
Yeah.
And it has gone up and back on appeal and it was totally fine. It was the way Alan handled it was totally fine. Like he was very careful about making sure that the pictures, were not suggestive. Right. All of the things that you were supposed to do, and not all the same people and not, not having it be suggestive in any way.
Right.
So that was certainly something that was challenged extensively at trial. And I think they even were like, oh, well, you used one of the same people or something. This photo line was like, okay, so why didn't they pick him out instead of Rashard? Because, if you're saying that the only person that was the same was Rashard, then they should have picked, just Rashard, but they didn't. They should have picked this other guy and they didn't. Yeah. So, I think he had, he handled that really, really well.
And that is why I'm glad it was Alan Sammons that handled that and not anybody else. Because that could have easily been messed up and we could have given the defense a better argument, but Alan Sammons, like you said, handled it perfectly. And
yeah,
it all went the way that it did because of him.
Right. Right. And again, you can't buy that. No. You cannot. But there was a lot of cool stuff with this. So you get some identification, you get confirmation too of where they're staying. And
yes.
So how did that happen?
So I asked dispatch to air every hour on the hour for 24 hours every single day until Ivory Carter's blue Nissan Murano was located. The description, information that this was taken in a homicide, and it was very crucial that we located that vehicle. So, I remember hearing it like every hour, description. And
it's 4:00. It's time to look for a Nissan Murano.
In fact, at one point, it took longer than one day. It was several days later that it was located. But I remember at one point not hearing the bolo anymore and thinking, where's my bolo? This vehicle hasn't been found yet and they're not airing it anymore. So I remember making a phone call and reminding dispatch, you guys need to keep airing it. So they started re-airing the bolo. I think they got tired of airing it every hour. And I don't know that most people did that, detectives, but I remember thinking,
No, most people don't. That's awesome though.
Yeah, this is my case and patrol doesn't need to forget about this vehicle. It's of high importance that we find it. So we're going to keep airing this until it's found.
Damn it.
Yeah. And at one point, and this never came out of trial, but it's just something interesting. Brian Holler, who was a precinct 4 detective, spotted it. It was on Styles, I believe. And I remember him calling me and being like, hey, I don't remember if he had just seen it or if he was like behind it, but he was like, I think he had just spotted it. And he was like, he told me he spotted it. And so he started following it loosely. And he gave me the description of the male driving it, and it matched Rashard's description. Like he had like twisties in his hair and like a darker skin, black male, and it matched Rashard, but he could never fully confirm it was Rashard, because as he started following it, the driver noticed Brian following him, and he pulled into like some little corner store or something. So Brian was kind of forced to keep going straight, so they kind of didn't give him up or whatever, because he was by himself, had no backup. I don't remember if I think he may have called it out on the radio, but at this time he's by himself with this potential murder suspect in this stolen car. So he did the right thing, and he kept going straight, trying to get more units. And then when he circled back, it was gone. So he couldn't positively ID Rashard at that time, but it definitely favored Rashard. But anyway, so we almost had the vehicle then, but we didn't. And so I was kind of bummed. I was like, oh man, like we had it and we had a driver in it and now it's gone, you know?
Right.
So I asked for the, not CSU, but it was, I forget the name right now of the unit, but the proactive guys.
I thought it was CSU, maybe not. Whatever their acronym
is. My husband was on this unit at one point. I can't think of the name. But anyways, it was a unit of proactive officers, you know, who are tasked to go out and find the big players in the community and arrest them. And I remember asking them, like, hey, or actually, you know what? Kristen Hardy, she was crucial in this. It was because Marty Singleton, because Laquan started using Marty Singleton's phone number. So I gave that information to Kristen Hardy, who was an analyst. And I said, hey, can you see like what link there is between Laquan and Marty and kind of just look into this angle for me? And so,
it was the address, wasn't it? It was something like that phone number went to Marty and Marty was at an address or something like that. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, but I remember also Kristen doing some really great work, and it involved Facebook. She found a picture of Marty Singleton on Facebook. And I think she was able to, see that Marty in this recent Facebook picture was on Cornwall Street. It wasn't through a database or something. I remember it took work. And it was because of Kristen's brilliant work. We learned that Marty lived on Cornwall, because I don't think it was documented. Like, I think somehow we had to like dig for that. And so I remember asking these officers, like, hey, can you check the area of Cornwall Street, you know, this entire neighborhood for this vehicle? And they located it, parked. Okay, you know what? Nope, that's what it was. They located the vehicle and it was in a vacant lot, but there was a house next door. And that's what it was. I asked Kristen to look into this address. I said, hey, this is where the vehicle is. It's not on anybody's, it's a vacant lot, but there's a house adjacent to it. I need to know everything you can find out about this house. And so she dug on the house, and then she learned that Marty Singleton lives there. And then we learned that Marty and Laquan are cousins, and that's when we were kind of piecing it all together. There was something with Facebook too that she found that was really crucial. I just can't think of right now.
Right. And I know there was Facebook stuff that was crucial in this, that was Laquan's Facebook. Like, she had been posting pictures night of the homicide, but I mean,
we knew she was wearing that night because of her own Facebook and Rashard. And that, right. That later was big with the hotel.
Right. Exactly. With the surveillance video and all that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was, and well, they took pictures in the hotel. So, yeah. But yeah, thank you. Thank you. Look what we're on. But the, you all got that address. They found the Murano, and I think they did a stakeout for a little bit, right? Didn't somebody see them coming out of the house?
Yeah, so that was my call, is that they do surveillance on it. And because I wanted somebody with that car, I didn't just want the car, I wanted a body with the car. So they set up and they did surveillance on it through the night. And at one point they snuck out to the car in the middle of the night and put a tracker on it just in case it got away from them. You know, we could track it. And I remember having a later conversation with my sergeant at the time, Sergeant Jackson, who's now a lieutenant, if not a captain, but when I left,
I think he might have retired actually, but that's
he
what
did,
I
heard. Actually, yeah. And he was a, you know, a great detective, did this many years. I remember him during the investigation, you know, telling me, and this was after, I think this was after Laquan and Rashard were caught. This was all after the fact, but he told me, like, you know, if it were my case, I would have sees that car right there, you know, we would have towed it, we would have processed it, because that's your crime scene. He was killed at the vehicle. You're probably going to have his blood in the car. That's your crime scene, and you can't let that go, and you can't risk somebody getting in that car and leaving with it. But he said, but you didn't make the wrong decision. You made the decision you made, and it was good for your case. But that's what I would have said. I would have done something different. But I am so glad that I made the decision that I made, because it turned out to be really good. And had we towed that car, we wouldn't have all the evidence that we got later, because right. we did surveillance and we didn't just tow it. But so, you know, they did surveillance through the night. Nobody gets into the vehicle. So, you know, they tell me basically like, hey, we can't keep, you know, surveilling this vehicle for days. But while they were doing surveillance of the vehicle, it was that next morning, the sun had come up, they were still watching it, and they saw Laquan and Richard come out of the house adjacent to where their car was, and they saw them walk to the street and they kissed. I don't know why you come out of the house and walk into the street and kiss, but that's what they did.
Bonnie and Clyde.
And yep, and then they went back into the house. So, and at that point, they were, Laquan and Richard were on our radar. Definitely Laquan because of the phone number and everything, but I didn't have anything on Richard, but because he was her boyfriend, they were always together. You know, yeah. I'm thinking this could be my trigger man.
Right. But, well, and yeah. Richard had outstanding warrants at that point. He had they both did.
Yeah.
Both had probation warrants. Now hers was misdemeanor, his was felony.
Okay.
But they both had warrants outstanding for probation violation, like they hadn't reported or done whatever. I think he had done something else, but I can't remember what it was. And so you get this positive ID.
Mm-hmm. So I get this positive ID, and based on them being at that house, the proximity of that house to Ivory Carter's vehicle, and then the fact that they had warrants and were wanted, I was able to get a search warrant for that house. And that was, and had we towed that car, you know, when it was found the day prior, we wouldn't have had Laquan and Richard at the house. We wouldn't have had the search warrant. This is why I say I was very glad I made the decision that I made. Sergeant Jackson would have made a different decision. And I'm not saying he would have been wrong. You know, that would have been his decision. And I'm not discrediting him. He's a fantastic detective, did this for many, many, many years, was a supervisor.
I had cases with him back in the day, like way back.
Yeah. You know, me being a very baby detective, maybe it could have been the wrong decision at some point.
It wasn't. Not in this case. It definitely wasn't.
In this particular case, with what we had, it was the right decision, and I'm glad I made it. So we get a search warrant for the house, SWAT hits it, and I think it was definitely Richard. It might've been both of them, hid in the bathroom and locked the bathroom door when SWAT busted in, and he refused to open the bathroom door. They had to like bust into the bathroom door to get him in custody. I don't remember if it was both of them in the bathroom, but it was definitely at least
Richard. I know Richard was. Yeah. It was like comical. Here's this big tough guy who just, Mr. Tough Guy on the streets hiding in the bathroom.
Yeah. So I was there when they hit it, and, when I, you know, saw them bring Brad out of the house in handcuffs, you know, it's like, all right, cool. They're in custody for their warrants. And I remember going into the house, and I think it was Puhala, or actually I think it was SWAT. Somebody told me early on, because SWAT had to flip a mattress to like make sure there wasn't a body, nobody hiding under this mattress in this bedroom. And when they flipped this mattress in between the
box springs.
Yes. The in between the box spring and the mattress, and they flip the mattress, they find the keys to the Nissan Murano, which was absolute gold. And then a firearm, which, well, we would later learn was the firearm used in the Frederick Knight shooting.
Right.
And
George Jackson's
keys. It was like the trifecta. I mean, it was like it was amazing. It was so good. It was like exactly what we needed.
Yeah.
And this is where, and I'm so glad Pujala was there and Pujala handled this, because my lack of experience, I would have, and I'm glad I didn't, and I'm glad it wasn't me that collected the evidence. I know better now, but I was a baby back then. And so I would have just taken the three items and put them all in one bag and we would have left and I would have been happy go lucky. Ooh, look at us, look what we got. Thankfully Pujala was there, and Pujala knows DNA and you know,
John's terrific.
I told him separately.
No, I told him, and again, it's like this was such a great team of homicide detectives at this period of time. It was just incredible. And so John, I told him I was going to talk about him with this case, and he's just like, "Well, I didn't do anything." I'm like, "Yes, you did. Stop it." But you know, he did such a terrific job, because he was like my forensics officer for like everything in the house, because he did everything himself. And I think some of it is he doesn't trust people, but I'm okay with that.
He should have trusted me back then, because back then I would have just bagged all of it in one. I didn't know any better. And I remember thinking, like, during the trial and all this, like, thank God I was not the one that collected those pieces of evidence. Thank God it was Pujala. You know, and that's the thing, is like, you learn as a baby detective, you learn things as you go. And I'm glad that I didn't have to learn like the hard way, like losing a trial. You know what I mean? I learned like, oh, okay, I'm glad he did it, and this is how it's supposed to be done, and not, oh, shoot, I did it and that was bad, and now we're going to lose this case because I messed this up. So
right. No, he really, and that is the best way to learn, in my opinion, is like, you know, we do all learn from our mistakes, and God knows I've made plenty. But I always liked to see people do it right and be like, ooh, that's cool.
Yeah. And that's how I learned. I was like, oh, that was good.
Yeah.
They can't say they tainted the evidence because they were bagged separately.
Yes.
On these items, it didn't rub off from the other items. It was because they were bagged separately. Thank you, Pujala.
Right. And all of, you know, he's like careful with his gloves and all the things. So yeah, there's no like tracer and none of that stuff. So yeah.
Well, I didn't even think about that. I just learned that. Like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. No, really, really did a great job with all of that stuff.
He took a class too. I think he testified in you know, so
yeah, he did. He testified in both trials. I mentioned it with Isabel, but you know, it's going to come up again, like just how mad he was at me in the second trial. Cause I, you know, because I had to stall with him on the stand, cause they had not brought the gun from, I guess where they had kept it after the first trial, the clerk's office had given it to the sheriff's department and they just didn't bring it to the courtroom. So I'm sitting there stalling and asking him all these really stupid questions. And you know, I know, like, everybody has their level of preparedness, and he's one of those people who likes to be very, very prepared. And I had prepared him as far as I thought I was going to be. And I'm just asking him a bunch of questions like, you did not tell me I had to answer this. You know, he's furious with me. I don't think he's forgiven me yet.
I was going to say, I'm sure he forgave you.
No,
sure.
Probably not. I don't know. But in any case, yeah. And he also had a big role later on with Laquan and her interview, but the second go round, but they both were taken into custody on the warrants that they had outstanding. And y'all interviewed, and I can't remember how this went, because Marty was taken in too. So I know Chris Ross had Marty because I have the t-shirt. I'm wearing the t-shirt when we talk about trial.
Yeah.
So I know Chris had Marty. I know that Alan had Rashard. Did you have Laquan? I think you did. The first go round. Yeah. So
I had Rashard too, but I asked Alan to kind of head up that interview because I was a little intimidated and scared of screwing it up. And Rashard was intimidating. I think he was only like 19 or 8.
She was 19. He was a little bit older. I thought he was like 21, 22, somewhere, 23, maybe. He was a little bit older than she was.
He wasn't 23. If she was 19, he was like 20 or 21. But
okay, I might have gotten wrong. I think 23 by the time he got to trial. You know, that might have been right.
I just remember, you know, like looking at him, and after he was arrested, he had no shirt on. He had these like baggy pants and like sagging, and you can see his boxer. He just looked like this tough guy. Like, I remember thinking, God, like, how am I going to talk to this, like this guy, get him to admit anything? Like, I remember, and Alan Sammons was like a savant, like in the interview. I mean, he was just, he was incredible with interviews. And to me, Alan was the best interviewer that we had. And so I remember asking him like, hey, I'll sit in there with you. I'll, you know, but can you head this one up? Cause if anybody can break him, it's you. So yeah, I was in there with him, but I did more talking with Laquan.
Right. And you know, when you say that, and I have to say this about Alan, I say this just like any opportunity I get, when you say he's a savant, you are so right. He just is like able to read like exactly how this person functions. And I'm not even sure if he can articulate it on some level, but some of it is just instinct. And you know, it's just instinct because it just comes out of him so quickly.
Yeah.
And you know, he measures the level in the room. Like, do I need to be the tough guy? Do I need to be like, you know, like rational? I mean, and that interview, I remember that interview with Rashard, there's a part where he's explaining what DNA evidence is that made me laugh so hard.
I could literally see Richard's heart thumping in his chest, like during that interview, because he had no shirt on. I mean, I could literally see, like, you could physically see his nervousness in his body. Yeah. It was amazing. And Alan Sammons is literally the most articulate person I've ever met. And I say that literally. He is the most articulate person I've ever met. And so it was just, for me, it was so fun. Like, cause the pressure was off of me. It was all on Alan, but it's not pressure to Alan. It would have been pressure to me. It wasn't pressure to Alan, but I remember sitting back and like being so entertained, like, man, he's getting him so good. Like, you can just see like you, and he just didn't know, like, obviously he's trying to like lie and like, you know,
be tough. Oh, Rashard was all about being tough. Yeah.
But I mean, you could see like his
he was sweating,
throbbing and like sweating and like just, you know, his heart throbbing. And just, it was amazing to see. And Alan was just like playing it cool, like Alan does, you know, and, you know, hey, I'm not saying you fired the gun. I'm just asking, you know, because like you said, he explained DNA evidence, and is your DNA going to come up on the gun at all? You know, did you touch it? I'm just saying, asking like, did you touch it? I'm not, you know, not that you shot it, you know, did you? And he got Rashard to admit that, yes, he touched it because he was going to steal it from whoever it was. It was
Sharkham Dunbar.
Yeah, Sharkham, Marty's boyfriend. It was his and he was going to take it. So that's why his DNA is on it. And so that was beautiful because he admitted that his DNA would be on it, which is all we were trying to do, you know.
Right. Right. But I just, there is a point at which, you know, that's one of those things that Alan does really well. It's like, you know, just lets them act like they're the smart person.
Uh-huh.
And just, you know, let it, you know, but yeah, I, well, let me explain how DNA works. Like, you know, DNA is like, you touch something and you touch the table and it's like, see, my DNA is there. Rashard's looking at it like, what? but yeah, and he's talking about like your sweat and your body fluids and you can see him like physically sweating. Rashard's like sweating.
Yeah, Rashard didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to say. It was so fun watching it.
Right, but they had a story and they had like, you know, this plan of what they were going to say, and Laquan told you a story at that point too. And I cannot remember the details of hers other than, you know, she was trying not to, y'all had confronted her about Frederick Knight. And did y'all talk about Prince Owens at that point? Cause I can't remember. You might not have talked about Prince Owens at that point.
No, I think we pretty much kept it to Frederick, and we didn't even go into the homicide because if she wasn't going to admit anything about Frederick, then there was no point in giving away what we were really there for.
Right.
So,
Right. So it was all about, and actually, I think even when Alan was talking to Richard, they were just talking about Frederick Knight's stuff, because, you know, I think y'all kept it to that because you didn't want to give too much away on the homicide at that point.
Yeah.
And it, again, you know, they had a story, and then y'all put them in the room together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, that's totally fine if you put them in the room together and they say stuff.
Yep.
What do you remember them talking about when they were in the room together?
I remember, like, they hugged and being all sweet to each other. And then I remember Laquan whispered something. And I'm trying. Do you remember what that was?
The one thing that I remember from this is that she used Frederick Knight's last name. Or like,
yes, that's what it was. He intentionally did not say Frederick's last name in the interview, and she denied knowing him.
Right. You know?
And she wasn't coming off of that. And then that's what it was. She whispered to Richard that, you know, we had asked her about Frederick Knight. And I remember, like, we were watching it, and we just, from our desks, we, like, collectively, like, celebrated, because that was, like, huge. Yeah, like,
yeah,
we got her kind of moment, at least on this one, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then it got even better. So y'all take both of them in custody, and the letter writing and phone calls start.
Yeah.
So what, and you, again, the whole jail call thing was still fairly new at that point. I mean, you all might have had access to jail calls before, like, 2013, but we certainly did not. And so jail calls and all of that stuff became such a big part of the investigative process.
Yeah.
In that stretch of time when the Sheriff's Department actually let y'all have access to that. So there were a bunch of things that happened right after that arrest that started to make this case, like, really incredible. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So after they were both arrested for Ivory's murder, I was listening to Richard's jail calls, and there was one, actually it was jail calls and visits, but this was a visit I was watching, and a female who actually he knew from being in the YDC, the youth detention center,
mm-hmm.
This lady came to visit him, which that's a whole nother conversation. I think it's a little inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Relationship with him in there, and now I was visiting him in big boy jail. But that's for another day.
Yeah.
Anyways, so he was telling her, yeah, Laquan's been writing me letters, da 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 da. And she's like, oh, you know, that's evidence. You know, you need to send those letters to me. And he you could kind of tell he wasn't really keen on that idea. And he's just kind of like, sorry. He was just kind of like skirting the idea. And she's like, no, really, like, you need to send me those letters. I think she's trying to, like, help him out, like, hey, like, you need to get rid of those letters. But, you know, those are from his girlfriend. He wants to keep them. So I remember as soon as he said that, I'm thinking, oh, yes, that is probable cause to get those letters. Like, I want those letters, and I need to get them now before he possibly gets rid of them, because she's really trying to get him to send them to her. So I think it was, like, that day or the very next day, I typed up a search warrant for his cell to get those letters, suspecting that they're discussing, you know, their case and maybe coming up with, you know, an alibi or something like that. So I get the search warrant typed up. I get the judge to sign it. I go to the jail. You know, they pull him out of his cell, and I go in there, and I take the letters, and he was probably, you know, crapping himself when I'm sure he was confused, like, why is, you know, she going to my cell. So I'm sure when he learned that I took the letters, he was you know, not happy about that. Right. So anyways, I get those letters, and then I read them, and I remember I went home that day, and I sat on my couch, and I was just, like, so excited to read these letters. Like,
they took hours. There's a lot of letters.
Yeah, I mean, I remember like getting home from work and like I could have like done anything. Like I could have like watched my favorite TV show. I was like, I came straight home and sat on the couch and I, you know, put the letters next to me and I just went through them one after another. Like I was just so like so looking forward to them, and for good reason. There was a lot of things in those letters that I remember actually, I think I called or texted you as I was going through them. I did. And
yeah.
Telling you like, hey, I'll get with you later on this, but I got these letters and they're gonna be huge.
Yeah, yeah. No, I got involved in this at some point, and I'm gonna back up a little bit because the letters were like so key, but and maybe I'm wrong, but I can't remember. Because I got involved in this, I remember that y'all brought like the crime spree to me, and they hadn't been charged with the murder yet. I remember being like, well, I'm not sure, you know how I am. You know, we've definitely got it on Frederick Knight. We need some work on this George Jackson thing. I want the DNA. I wanted the DNA on the keys because he didn't ID. I remember like Becca had shown him photo lines and he did not ID Laquan. It's just, it looks like her kind of thing. And I really was concerned that that case wasn't strong enough at that point in time. And then y'all were like, but we got this murder. And I'm like, okay, that's great. But you know, what do we have as far as like, because you, I think, had just gotten maybe the surveillance video. And there was a debate in my head too about what do we do with Keith Johnson? So there was a whole bunch of stuff. Like this was going into September and, you know, Frederick Knight's case was charged. But I think part of what opened it up too is Prince Owens came forward because he got a letter from Laquan. Mm-hmm. And I think he may have brought it. It may have been part of Alan's case, may have been part of the Frederick Knight thing. Like he brought that letter to SPD and Alan interviewed him. And he's like, look, this woman's trying to get me to influence this witness not to come to court. And it had like all of this information because Laquan was quite the writer. When you got these letters, and I think, and I'm trying to remember where in the scheme of things, because it would have been before the letters that y'all interviewed her on the murder. She got arrested on the murder before those letters, I think, before we got those. And the reason I say that is she talks about Sharkham in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, yeah. So I cannot remember. I know it was sometime maybe in September that y'all brought her in to basically serve her with the arrest warrant for Ivory's murder. And I can't remember exactly what had like pushed it over the edge, but somewhere in here, we have got to talk about Tom Cerbone.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, on our side of the fence, as an assistant DA, and he was the chief assistant of our early intervention program for quite some time. Before that, he had been my trial partner. Just awesome. I mean, he went way, way back in the office as far as experience, and you've been involved in death penalty cases, and you know, Tom had this huge amount of experience, but also could like just really get it like super fast. And he was at that point basically consulting with y'all, I think, on just about every homicide.
Yes.
So Tom, and by consulting, not like telling you what to do necessarily, but like answering legal questions, like, you know, helping with that. And he was involved even in the search warrants on the letters, if I remember right. But the interview with Laquan, y'all decided to serve her with the arrest warrant for Ivory's murder. That was a very technical thing that happened.
Yeah.
And can you talk about what happened with Laquan and the arrest warrant?
Yeah, so I had interviewed Laquan's mom during my investigation into the murder because I needed to confirm that 864 number was Laquan's. So I brought her mom in, and her mom actually did confirm that was Laquan's phone number. So that was huge for me. And Laquan's mom is like, she was like a nice woman. Like she just
came
with your like your average, you know, hardworking, down to earth mom. She took care of like multiple kids. She had multiple kids that she took care of. I think she was a single mom. But she's just, you know, very nice, very humble. Like, so I built a good rapport with her like during that interview. And so when we had the arrest warrant for Laquan, I wanted to give her like an opportunity to see Laquan at headquarters, because, you know, she couldn't like touch her at when she's in jail. She can't like see her face to face, hug her, touch her. So I called Laquan's mom and I kind of broke the bad news to her. I said, hey, you know, we've got an arrest warrant for Laquan for murder. You know, I said, if you want to see her here at headquarters, she's going to be here. You can, you know, talk to her and hug her if you want. And she like very quickly said, I'll be there in, you know, however many minutes. She was on her way at that point.
Right. So, and I wanted to say this too, because, you know, it's such a heartbreaking thing. It was heartbreaking to watch. But she really struck me as somebody, you know, she had a lot of emotions going on too, because Laquan was pregnant
mm-hmm.
by Rashard.
Yep.
And so, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes with that too. You know, your child is pregnant with, you know, just there's a lot. And Laquan had been, if I remember right, Laquan had been on the streets since she was 15.
Yeah.
And not, right, but not because mom didn't want her or wouldn't take care of her, but because she just ran the streets.
Yeah. Yeah, so, she's been her life.
Yeah. So she shows up at headquarters, mom does. And wasn't there an aunt that came as well?
Yeah, I think I told her mom, and if you want to bring somebody with you, you know, for support, that's fine. And so she brought her sister, Laquan's aunt, with her.
Right. And did you pick up Laquan from the jail, or was it somebody else? I know Pujala is involved in this, but yeah.
I think I did. I don't remember that ride back to headquarters, but I believe that was me.
Okay. So you get her back to headquarters, and was it Pujala that talked to her first, read her Miranda?
Yeah.
Okay. And again, I think he did this perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Because he read her Miranda and she said that she didn't want to talk.
Yes.
And I don't know if y'all had gotten her breakfast already, or you were going to get her breakfast. There was breakfast involved in this.
I don't remember exactly where in that we did, but I mean, obviously, you know, we knew she was pregnant and it was the morning time. And I think maybe we were going to make her miss, you know, breakfast at jail or something. So we wanted to make sure she was fed.
Right. And her mom asked to talk to her, if I remember right.
I think after she said she wanted a lawyer, Pujala told her that her mom was there and asked her if she wanted to see her mom or talk to her mom, and she said yes.
Okay. And her mom went in and talked to her.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about that conversation?
Well, I remember very distinctly that I do remember her mom telling her, well, I remember Laquan like lying about the stolen car. She was trying to tell her mom, oh, you know, somebody asked me if I wanted it for $50 and I took it. And I remember, I think it was her mom. It was either her mom or her aunt, but I think this was her mom being like, you know, you took a car for $50 and you didn't think it was stolen? Like, this story doesn't make any sense. Like, even her mom was calling her out on her lies. And then I remember specifically her mom saying, they wouldn't be charging you with murder if they didn't have all their I's dotted and their T's crossed. Like, basically her mom was saying, like, you're full of crap and you're lying to me. Cause she told her mom like several different stories about the car. That was one of them. But, and her mom was like calling her on her BS. Like, this is serious. And, you know, I remember her mom like just not buying any of it.
Right.
She was a smart woman.
Right. And I remember her kind of being in tears at the end. I remember her aunt being tough with her too. Because she has to talk to her aunt, if I remember right.
But also so loving. Like, I remember her aunt encouraged her and like really like kind of speaking like life lessons into Laquan. And I remember like all of us watching it, and even like after the fact, like you guys watching it, like it was really emotional watching. I mean, her mom, but especially for some reason, like her aunt, like what her aunt, the way that she spoke to her and the words that she said and the way that she loved on Laquan, it was really like moving.
Well, right. And part of what she said, if I remember right, was, you know, this is a human being. You owe him the truth. You know, you owe it, essentially that, like, you know, you need to tell the truth about this man's life. You know, if you know what happened, you need to tell him.
Yeah. And a lot of these murder suspects that we deal with come from, you know, broken homes and really bad situations. And this one was just so different because Laquan didn't come from any of that. Like, she had these great people behind her and that had raised her. And it was just so different than most of these other situations, which is, I think, another reason why. Because, I mean, you know, a lot of these family members of these murder suspects are, they're not, you know, they don't care. They're just as cold as their family member who's being arrested for murder. And it's not about the victim. It's about, you know, what they can do to help their family member, you know. And it's, but this was like Laquan's family was like, you know, they cared about Ivory. And you just don't see that a lot, especially in Savannah.
No, that's true. And I remember just being proud of them for being stand-up people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they did. They hugged her and said, you know, you need to do the right thing. And after that, I think Puhala stuck his head and said, "You okay?" And she's like, "I want to talk to you."
Yeah. Oh, and
they left. I'm sorry.
I just remembered something else that Laquan's mom said to her. I remember specifically her saying she was upset with Laquan about kind of being a follower with Rashard and kind of like following his lead and, you know, follow, you know. And I remember her saying, "I patted your butt as a baby and as a little girl so that you wouldn't need no man. You wouldn't need a man. Like, you wouldn't need a man's affections. Like, you have me, you have us." Like, I remember like that really like touched me too. Like her saying that, you know, like she didn't want her to follow any man, especially like, or follow a man down this path. Like,
yeah,
she tried to like instill that in her as a baby and as a really a little girl, to the point where she had her butt, you know, like so that she wouldn't need a man's, you know, touch her affections. Like, I don't know. It just, I mean, this is 8 years ago now. And
yeah.
I distinctly remember that person.
Yeah. Well, and again, you talk about life lessons, you know, things that as, you know, you come into your own, you know, like having family and stuff like that. And it changes the way you view the world when you see, you know, all of the bad things that can happen. And you know, how do you get through to people? And you know, they were saying all the right stuff. Anyway, I remember Puhala, like after they had left, he stuck his head in and he's like, "Hey, do you mean anything?" Like she's eating a biscuit or something. And "Hey, do you mean anything?" And she's like, "Hey, I want to talk to you." And he goes back in and he's like, "Look, you said that I need to go through all this, Miranda, with you." And she did, and she waved. And then, was it you and Brandon Lord? I have it in my head that it was you and Brandon Lord.
Yeah, it was. It might have been somebody else prior to that. Because I think there were several of us that talked to her. I think we talked to her about the some of the robberies, but then at the end, yes, it was me and Detective Lord.
Okay. And what, how do you remember this going as far as like the stories she was telling you? Because she didn't tell all of it. She told it most of it, but she didn't tell all of it.
Yeah, she didn't want to give up Richard. Like she, at a certain point, I think she admitted that, you know, she was involved in the homicide, and obviously we wanted to know who the trigger man was, and she did not want to save Richard. She did not want to give him up, you know, because she was like a ride or die. Like she was tough. Like she wasn't soft cookie. She was seasoned at her young age, and that was her man, and she loved him, and she did not want to give it. And I didn't think we were going to get it out of her. And then, and this is where I will give Brandon Lord so much credit. He took off his badge, put it face down on the table, and was like, I'm not talking to you as officer, you know, suspect anymore. I'm talking to you person to person. You know, this isn't you. Like, this is not you. And you do not need to cover for anybody who took the life of an innocent person. And I remember him just like really connecting with her on that level. And, you know, I've never seen Brandon do a better job than in that moment. Like that was, she would not have said what she said after that had it not been for him. And that was all him. And he broke her down, and I think she started crying, and she finally admitted that it was Richard. And I mean, she just barely did it. I want to say it was even hard for her. It was even hard to hear her say it. I mean, it was low, and but she finally gave him up that it was Richard. And then fast forward to, you know, she tried to recant that, you know, later on. But we knew that in that moment, that was the truth. And that's what truly happened. And you weren't going to convince anybody else that anything you said after that fact was going to be anything different. Because obviously she had a change of heart after talking to Richard in the letters and stuff like that, and having more time to think about it. And later on, she wanted to say it was Keith, you know, because it was easier for her to throw Keith under the bus than Richard.
Oh, yeah.
She was willing to throw her own family member under the bus.
That's right.
She loved this.
Right. Know. I mean, and there were the letters that you got, and it gave so much context to her mental process. But I agree with you. In that moment, part of the reason that you know that she's telling the truth is that she's like buku crying. I mean, she is wailing.
Yeah.
And she finally admitted that, you know, she was part of this robbery with Ivory and the murder. And then when she finally broke down about Richard being there, she just, it was like, you could tell it was like ripping it out of her.
It was so hard for her to say that.
Right. And, you know, the things that came later in the letters were, you could see her going through like, so let's talk about these letters. So you get the search warrant, you get these letters. And I remember that you wanted to get like a search warrant for her cell, like right away. And I think Tom talked you out of it and said you had to read the letters first.
Yeah. Tom was amazing. He always was, oh man, he was brutal. I'd type up a search warrant, he'd red pen all over it. It was always, even like, this is sorry, a little off topic, but even like months and years later, I'm like, all right, I've been doing this for so long. I've got it down. I know exactly what I need to put a search warrant. I know Tom Sorbone. I know what he's going to look for. I'd send him my search warrant, like knowing it's perfect, and he'd still red pen. He was so brutal, but it was so good. He'd make you so good with your search warrant. Yes. You knew, like you learned over time, like exactly what you needed, the verbiage, the detail, I love Tom. He's made me such like a better, like I'm a deputy now, like deputy officer back then, detective, it's all the same, but whatever title you give me, it's made me such a better law enforcement officer because the way that he was just like so brutal with those search warrants. But anyways, yeah, that So I remember I got Laquan's letters. I remember, like you said, going to Tom being like, all right, cool. I need to get his now because I have hers. I need to get his letters. You're like, nope, you got to read them first and you got to establish probable cause through those letters first. I'm like, all right. I know I'll get it, but I'll do it. I am.
Right, because you have to prove that there are letters in her cell. Otherwise, yeah. There's no basis for a search warrant.
Exactly.
Absolutely right. And I have to say this about Tom, and you know, it was years and years and years of experience with him, but he also had been at the counter-narcotics team. And that is like nothing but search warrants. I mean, search warrants, wiretaps, all of that stuff. He knew the technicalities of that stuff inside and out, because you know that's the stuff that gets challenged all the time in those cases. And it would get challenged on the federal level too. So, I mean, he'd been through everything there was to know about like Fourth Amendment stuff. So yeah, he's the guy.
Our search warrants never got challenged. Thanks to Tom.
Tom knew what he was doing. So you get the letters and you text me, I got these letters and they're awesome. And I think you might have texted me a picture of like something, cause she had drawings.
Yes. I probably did. Yeah.
The drawings were priceless, and like they're all these little like references. So talk about that, because it's such a big, unusual, unique part of this case.
Yeah. So it wasn't her drawing. She had her cellmate who was good at drawings, like draw these intricate pictures on her letters for Rashard. So one of the drawings, and we laugh about it all the time every time we talk about this case, it's of a gun.
Yes.
It's a very well-drawn firearm, very, you know,
accurate.
You know, very accurate. And I think in the gun, is it? Now correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a while since I've seen it, but there's a picture of Laquan and Rashard kissing, like inside the gun.
Yeah, and there's like a heart.
Yeah, it's like in the frame of a heart with them kissing inside this firearm. And then I think, you know, it says like above it, like 143 forever and always, which 143 is I love you. And then Bonnie and Clyde. And she, in the letter, she like proudly, repeatedly calls them Bonnie and Clyde and refers to them as Bonnie and Clyde. And it's funny because Rashard never... Not one time did he like agree with that or refer to them as Bonnie and Clyde or go down that. Rashard seemed to be like more like worried, like, you know, like she to her, it was like a big game. Like she thought it was cute. And I got all these girls in here laughing, calling us Bonnie and Clyde. And I think it's funny and da 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 da. And he's like down to business in his letters, like no funny business. He's worried. And he's like, hey, what exactly did you tell the cops? And, you know, like, you know, and she, you know, and she does try to give him defenses in her letters.
She's telling him what to say.
Yeah. Like, so the letter after that interview with me and Brandon Moore, it was very like sobering to him. She's, you know, she apologizes immensely for telling us, you know, and I don't even remember. I don't think she like came out and directly said it. Like I told them you did it, but basically she's like apologetic, like inferring, like I told them, but without telling him, because she just couldn't bring herself to actually tell
admit
him.
It.
Yeah. Admit it, but she pretty much says it without saying it and apologizes profusely for talking to us and telling us what happened and da 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 da. And then, you know, later on, she tells him, you know, tell them, you know, you were high on, you know, whatever drugs. Tell them that, you know, and she also like tries to get him to, she tells him to tell the deputies in the jail that, you know, he needs mental health services and he needs these drugs for mental health. And kind of like she's basically telling him, like, hey, build your defense, like build your insanity mental health defense, start now, and tell them that you're crazy so you can start, you know, start down this path with this defense.
Yeah,
And yeah, then, so she's very specific too. Like, you know, she talks about, like, I can't wait to get back to our Bonnie and Clyde lifestyle. And
this time we're gonna do it right. Remember, she said,
yeah, this time we're gonna, oh, you're right, I'd forgotten that. This time we're gonna do it right. And like,
and you brought that up, and Trout, wait, like, what is, yeah, and Trout, you said, what does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, when they get out, we're gonna not get caught next time, you know? And you did a great job in trial of hammering that.
I'm glad you said that, because I don't remember what I said. Yeah.
You focused in on that in the letters.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in there that she was talking about, like, we need to put it on Keith. Because at that point we had the surveillance video. We knew that Keith had gone with them and come back with them at the time of the homicide, mm-hmm. because of the surveillance video. And so, you know, it was going to be a question of, was it Keith or was it Rashard that pulled the trigger? And she had said it was Rashard, obviously, in the interview that she had with you. But, you know, Keith's got a record. You know, there's always that going to be that question. Mm-hmm. But when she starts talking about, you need to put it on Keith, it makes it kind of clear, like, okay, it wasn't Keith.
Yeah.
Well, and she had said that, too, about Sharkham. Like, she was trying to make up some weird story, like, Sharkham was supposed to meet them. I mean, there was like, I that might have been the statement she gave to you, but Sharkham was Marty's boyfriend. Sharkham, again, criminal history. And of course, I've talked about Sharkham's sister, Shanika, because I prosecuted her for murder and she's doing life without parole. But Sharkham was definitely a possible suspect for Frederick Knight's stuff, because that's Marty's house. Yeah. But again, you're starting to put it on somebody. Why are you telling him to say this if it's, you know, why does he need to be told, right?
Yeah.
If it was true, you wouldn't need to tell him.
Yeah.
That was like, huge. Those letters were amazing. And, you know, we got his letters to her. And, you know, it reinforced some of it. Like, you know, he's forgiving her and stuff like that. But I don't remember anything like, quite as specific.
No, he really didn't give us anything to use against him in the letters. He was pretty smart about his letters.
Yeah. I mean, it reinforced, like, she's involved for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, he didn't give us a whole lot, but she was telling him, and I guess, you know, like, because he had been in the youth detention center, like, oh, you know how to do the mental health thing. Like, he must have done that when he was in YDC before. I, you know, it is, they know the system better than we do.
I think she even said in the letters, like, put the pill in your mouth and then, like, spit it out. Like,
yeah.
I think something like that.
Yeah.
Like the pills that they give for
it. Right. And didn't she send you, like, she sent you, like, a full recantation at some point in time, didn't she? Or tried to, she was going to, like, she written it out.
She wanted to talk again, but in her letter she said, you know, I'm going to tell him the truth. I'm going to tell him that Keith did it. And she reached back out because she wanted to tell us that Keith did it. And we rejected it. We're like, no, we're good. We don't need to talk to you anymore. You know, we can go through this over and over, go, you know, talk to you X amount of times and you're just going to tell us a different story every time. But we, you know, based on the evidence that we had, we knew that Rashard pulled the trigger. We had all the evidence we needed, and we didn't need to keep talking about it. We didn't need to keep, you know, hearing lies from her. So,
yeah. Well, and her, you know, we did eventually, and I think it might have been after the lawyers, we got the DNA back on the gun and both sets of keys, and it was hers. And her DNA was in the Murano.
Yeah, her DNA was on the steering wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was talking about how she was a secretor and Rashard really wasn't, because his DNA wasn't on, was it on the firearm? Was it on anything?
No, his DNA was not.
His.
But there was other stuff, obviously, you know, like the surveillance video and whatever. There was other stuff in the vehicle too. Like, there was a receipt from, I can't remember. There might have been like the bank stuff that Ivory should have had, like, he'd gone to get cash to give her.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there were messages on his phone. She'd left a voicemail, like, oh, you know, I need dinner, I haven't eaten, you know, those kinds of things. And you know, she prayed on him. So we got like all of this stuff, and it was like a really incredible big case. And I was really excited because it was really cool. And, you know, and part of what was cool about it, you know, though, is that at that point in time, we're just really rolling with the major case unit on our end. And so I was getting to work with like some other really great prosecutors. And so I got Isabel to agree to try the case with me. And that was really fun. I think we had, you know, such a good team for this case, because, you know, we had like practically every superstar in homicide. And
I wasn't a superstar. I was just trying to make a name for myself and be decent and not screw things up. I wasn't
that. Hey, me too. Me too. It's just like, hey, you know, I can get it done. You know, I can get it over the goal line, right?
The stars were Simmons and Puhala.
Yeah, we had some awesome people. Yeah, and Ross. So I want to talk about like the trial. I do want you and Isabel to have the opportunity to like sit and catch up a little bit and you just kind of reminisce about this, because this case, you know, it really highlights what an important thing it is to have not only experienced people, but like a team of experienced people, because you learn so much.
Yeah.
From your experience informs me, and you know, Isabel's experience. I mean, we learn from each other, and you learn from, hey, you did this really well, yeah, like you're talking about, as opposed to just learning from fucking things up, yeah. Which does happen too.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was a great case for that for me, because I got to learn so much from just watching all of y'all working together so well. So I do want to get us all together.
As you have heard, this extremely detailed investigation had so many unique elements and uncommon legal issues, it would take more than one legal mind to ensure that justice would be done. I needed help, and I turned to a great legal scholar, Isabel Pauly. In our next episode, hear how Isabel helped all of us see the big picture and keep the truth in focus. Due to scheduling conflicts, these episodes will be spread out over the next few weeks, but tune in to find out if the podcasting world, like the legal world, is ready for Isabel Pauly. Join us.